What if I told you that one of the biggest financial mistakes most high-earning physicians make isn't overspending? In fact, it might be the exact opposite. Keep listening as we dive in. Welcome to the Money Meets Medicine podcast, where we talk all about the personal finance topics you wish you had learned in medical school. I'm your host, Justin Harvey, and here is your co-host who definitely did not live like a resident when he finished training, Dr. Jimmy Turner.
Yes, that's a true story. This is one of the things that's always separated me in the personal finance space for physicians is that I have always done things that most people say, you can't do that. You absolutely cannot do that. Like when I finished training and I financed a car and didn't put a single dollar down on the car, got a country club membership, and then proceeded to pay off $200,000 in student loans and make massive financial gains during that process. And this is going to be the theme on this show. I'm really not a fan of when people try to paint you into one corner or the other. Like, moderation is such an important thing in life. And so longtime listeners know that I'm a huge proponent of the 10% rule. So I took the difference between my last paycheck as a resident, my first paycheck as an attending, the difference between those two things, I took 10%, and every single month I spent it on whatever I wanted, which happened to be those two things I just mentioned. So I'm a big car guy, as anyone who has listened to the show for any amount of time knows. And yeah, I did not live like a resident. And I think it's kind of silly, to be honest, to do that when you've worked so hard to get to where you are. Like, you absolutely deserve to spend and enjoy a little bit of what you've created, in my opinion.
Couldn't agree more. And yeah, we still have to do this episode, Jimmy, because I think about it now and then. The things I've changed my mind about over time, because there's a lot of them. And the more I see, the more I'm like, oh yeah, I don't think what I used to. But, you know, as I have said in the past, there's no one who knows more in the world than the 25-year-old CFP who's going to fix your wagon, by golly, because look, you just bought another latte and you just pushed off financial independence by another 14 minutes. And every day you drink a latte, it compounds. And it's very paternalistic. Let me tell you what to do. I started there just like all the other young CFPs. And then I came back to, let's present some options. And like, I'm not going to paint you into a corner. I'm not going to tell you what you can't do. Let me just put it all out there. And then, funny enough, Jimmy, in terms of the actual experiential engagement of the like rendering financial services to people, I have found that often what people want isn't, here are six different options and let me quantify them. They're just like, just tell me what to do. Yep. I pay you, so I don't have to think about this. You know me, just tell me what to do. So I like to not paint people into a corner, but I try to bias towards certainty in the way that I present people's circumstances. So I'm curious to see how this conversation goes.
I couldn't agree more. And for me, the way that I help people with that is by providing frameworks and rules of thumb, if you will, to help them get through that gray territory, which is life. Because to your point, if you go one direction or the other, neither of them are healthy. And we're going to talk about both of them on the show, which makes it a little bit unusual. And this is why Money Meets Medicine is different, because most of the content that a lot of people put out will talk about how you just need to save more, invest more, keep your expenses down, automate the boring parts. And in 20 years or 30 years, you're going to be fine. And that's kind of mostly right. Like, those are good principles to have. I think that they're reasonable things to talk about. But there's also this other phenomenon that happens, and we'll paint the arc here in a second for the typical traditional journey from a doctor who gets exposed to personal finance and then the journey they go through and the problems that it causes here in just a second. But before we do that, it is April as we record this, and it's going to be April when the show comes out, actually, as I went to San Diego, Padres game, ton of fun, but got behind on recording. So we've caught up to almost real time at this point. That said, April, May, and June, this is the time of the year that I just scream it from the mountaintops that if you're a resident finishing training, you absolutely need to get disability insurance before you finish training, because 50% of you listening need to get a guaranteed standard issue policy because of your medical history, things like anxiety, depression, obesity, diabetes, right? Like, there are common things that are amongst us as a physician crowd that actually need you to get a disability insurance policy that is a GSI variety, and that is only available in training. So please, 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 if you're listening to this, if you have friends that listen to this that are finishing training, do not let them finish residency or your terminal fellowship, if that's what you're in, without getting disability insurance. It's a catastrophic financial mistake if you do, for a lot of doctors. And every time I talk about this time of year, 5 months from now, I'll be telling you the horror story of the one person who found my stuff late and didn't do this. So don't let that be you. Go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability, click get a quote, and we can set you up for all of your options as they are where you are in training, including any GSIs that might exist. So Justin, maybe let's paint the journey first, because I think this is helpful. But this was my journey too, but fortunately I got this interrupted at the right point in my life, which is that a lot of doctors are financially illiterate. We know that from studies. That's not just my opinion. Doctors, by and large, don't know a lot about personal finance. It's not taught in college. It's not taught in most medical schools, with the exception of very few rare exceptions, like where I teach a 10-week curriculum at Wake Forest every year for the fourth year students there. And so because of that, we go through residency. And again, we don't learn it. And then we get a big old paycheck in July after our training ends. And we experience the Diderot effect that I love to talk about on the show, right? Where we come into the sudden accumulation of wealth. And then all of a sudden our spending matches our accumulation. And despite having a really large set of money, we go broke. So that is the common trajectory, which is what led to all of these messages in the personal finance space for physicians that you need to be frugal. You need to live like a resident. You need to not expand your lifestyle when you finish training, because for years and years and years, and still to this day, people that aren't financially literate, that's exactly what happens, right? And so that said, there's another problem that doesn't get talked about enough, in my opinion, which I think we're going to focus on this show about, which is that once you do become financially literate, your story takes a giant branch point. There's a fork in the road. And you're no longer going to be going towards that Diderot effect because you know it exists. And what happens is you turn into a super saver. And then you have a hard time spending money. And then you have a hard time flipping the switch to spend more when you want to get to retirement and you need to start spending more money to enjoy your life. And probably the two most common places that I see this happen is when somebody comes up to me, like, Jimmy, I'm really burned out in medicine. I don't know what to do. And we talk finances and I'm a completely open book. So people interestingly share all their numbers with me. And it's always been that way. So they're like, yeah, well, this is how much I've saved. And this is, you know, how much I spend. And we just run the really back of the napkin, quick math. And I show them, like, you've actually done really, really well because you are financially literate and you have saved a lot of money. And believe it or not, you don't have to save another dollar and you will be able to retire when you're 60 or 65 and you could go part-time right now. Because they're like, I just need more time back. I'm just burned out in medicine. I just need more time. What if I told you right now, you could cut back to 3 days or 4 days a week? And they're like, no way. Yeah, it's math. It's just math. These are mathematical facts in a lot of ways. And so that's one area where I see it, because they have a really hard time. Like, I see the math. I understand what you're saying, but I just can't believe it. And it's really hard to save less money, to go from saving $100,000+ a year to saving 50 or 30, because you now know you have accumulated enough money in your first 5 to 10 years out that you actually don't have to keep saving. That is a scary place to be for a lot of doctors. And I run into it all the time.
It is, because it's the identity crisis moment where there's assumptions about what your future is going to be and who you are that's living into that future. Now, all of a sudden, you have a lot more autonomy, a lot more decision-making power than you ever perhaps hoped you would. Kind of reminds me of the person who's been in jail for 20 years and they get out of jail. It's like there's a moment of like, oh my gosh, there's the realization of I'm free. But then there's the structure was what was holding me together. And now I have to like learn new skills and go to the grocery store and buy my own clothes. And it was kind of safer on the inside. And this is a documented, you know, phenomenon too, that recidivism among people because of the psychological comfort really of not having to make a lot of those decisions is, yeah, it's a real thing. So knowing that it's coming and beginning to build those mental and emotional muscles is an important part of navigating that successfully.
Yeah. I think another identity piece that taps into this is that people start to get an identity of frugality in some ways. And it's kind of akin to, I was never in the Peace Corps. I never served in any way, shape, or form in something like the Peace Corps, but I have friends who did. And it was interesting to me that they would tell stories of people who basically tried to live on the least possible means imaginable. It was basically a race, a competition to see who could live the most depraved life while having these service-minded.
Deprived.
Yes, deprived. And so it was interesting to me that there was almost a competition for frugality. And sometimes in the personal finance space, I see it the same way, where people have this mentality that I am just a frugal person and I have found financial success because I am a frugal person. And if I stop being frugal, the financial success will fade away because I have this scarcity mindset where this just isn't permanent and I don't think that it's going to last. And so if I start spending money and I become Diderot, even though you save so much money, it would be really, really hard to do that. That identity piece is wrapped up into that frugality as well. And I see this happen where people have lots and lots and lots of money and they just have a hard time spending it. And even when you get really mathematical, really factual about it, I find that that's true. And another thing that happens there too, I think, is that people start to say, yeah, but I'm saving this so I can enjoy it later. And it reminds me of Jordan Grummet, I think, is the person that I saw that had this blog post way back in the day. It said, it's about one more year syndrome. and which is so common, I'm sure, for you for financial planning side of things, but where people like, yeah, no, I've saved enough, but I'm just going to work one more year. And then it turns into one more year and then to one more year because they just have a really hard time flipping the switch and becoming spenders instead of accumulators. And so there's so much identity, like the identity of frugality, the identity of being a saver, the identity of being a physician, the identity of whatever it might be for you. And there really is a lot of emotional and thought work that has to go into what is enough and when can you flip that switch? And would it be okay to go part-time right now? Would it be possible for you to retire at 55? Or is it just one more year because I don't want to go through the emotional struggle of having to answer those existential questions?
That's precisely my thoughts about why this exists. It's not a math challenge. It's easy to be busy and not think about meaning and purpose because you're busy with the tactics of day-to-day existence. But once you're no longer encumbered with the need for the tactics, then you're forced to say, what's the point? And sometimes staring that in the face is, I mean, obviously it's an enormous, important question and it makes some people so uncomfortable that they'd rather just keep on doing what they're doing as a way to distract themselves from not having to think about it.
And we've talked about this before on the podcast, but one of the ways that I've personally been able to make this switch, because I was the same way. We saved over $100,000 a year when I finished training and my base salary back then was 315. I think with bonuses and stuff, it might've gotten to like 350, 375, but I was saving over a third of our income every year and making tremendous financial progress. And I'm really glad for those years because those years early on were what set me up to be able to go part-time in my mid-30s. And so it really paid off, but flipping that switch to save less money, which did and has prolonged my timeline by a few years. So I used to be able to say, and you go back and read my blog content, right? It's often hilarious going back and reading stuff that you wrote 10 years ago and Nostradamus version of Jimmy in terms of when he thinks he will retire and how much money he thinks he will need. It turns out those things change as you get older, my friend, but a little older, a little wiser. But when I look back at that and I look at the numbers, you know, I'm to be financially independent in my mid-40s and I am 40 now. And we in our mid-30s made a very conscious decision to start saving less money and to push that back and probably closer to 50 by traditional standards, right? In terms of what I have saved in retirement vehicles and other savings vehicles. And the reason that switch got flipped is because I started really thinking about, okay, my kids only have so many years left with them. I have three kids. Even with my youngest kid, we only have 9 years left in the house before she goes to college or whatever she decides to do with her life. She's a free spirit, so I'm not sure what she's going to do, but fully and totally support it. But yeah, so when I started thinking about that and it put a very concrete timeline on it for me that, wow, if I don't create more time in my life right now, I'm not going to have the opportunity to do all these things that I want to do with my kids. And so I took a job in Statesville, right? 30 minutes from my house to the west instead of 30 minutes to the east. And I get done at pretty much 3 o'clock every single day. I help coach my kids' baseball team, Wesley's baseball team. I never miss a practice. I never miss a game. I'm at all the flute recitals for the girls and supportive of them and the things that they're doing as well. And I took a massive pay cut for that. And I could take the massive pay cut because I can save less money because I saved so much early on. And so I did have to flip that switch myself and start saving. We save substantially less money now at 40 than I did when I was even 32, 33 years old. And what allowed me to answer those existential questions and to do the tough mental thought work in order to make the transition from being a super saver to someone who saves moderately and has more time was the timeline of my kids. That was very concrete, very easy to understand. And kind of forced it for me.
Yeah. The scarcity of resources is what assigns value to them in this case. And when you have less money or not enough money or you're massively negative net worth in debt, then money is the resource that you feel the lack of most acutely and that you're most motivated to advance. But then once your net worth is no longer negative, and then once it's pushing towards seven figures and beyond, the other resources come into play. And Jimmy, you and I were joking before we hit record here about how we're both super stressed because we spent the weekend, a long weekend, you know, doing things with our families. And now it's like, it's go time. The inbox is overflowing and people are impatiently waiting for our attention. And I feel the time scarcity so acutely. And, you know, as a father, I want to spend as much of that with my family as possible. And so I'm right there with you.
Yeah, it's tough. And I think that something that you and I talked about on a personal level before we hit record is that when we get really busy in our lives, we don't really leave time for that soul searching, for that time for the tough questions, the time to sit down and pray about it, think about it. What's the Lord lead me to do right now in my life? And I've been so guilty of that personally the last 6 months, just being so busy with the job transition, money meets medicine, and the new Instagram account that has blown up in a way I never imagined it would and taking over my life. So, you know, like reining those things back in and creating the time to have these tough conversations, to have these tough existential questions answered, it doesn't happen if you're so busy. And I feel like for me, that's actually one of the best ways I've dealt with this in the past. And I clearly am at the stage of my life right now where I need to do it again, is sitting down and being deliberate and putting the phones away, putting them on silent, which Kristen would love. That is a common thing in our house that we end up having lots of conversations about. Being an online business owner, you can imagine I have access to my business 24 hours a day through this smartphone in my pocket. And so it's putting the phones down, answering the questions. I know you and I both really like the Kinder questions as a source of maybe a place to start these conversations. And I think it's good to revisit those because the answers that you maybe gave 10 years ago when you first did them, and maybe 5 years ago when you repeated them, and now that they likely have different answers, flavor or flair or bent to them now that you're a little bit older, right? And so these are not things you should do once, in my opinion. These are things you should revisit. And now I'm saying this out loud publicly on a podcast where thousands of people are listening. It's something that I personally need to do. So this is a call to action to me just as much as it is to you to have a sit down with a loved one and sort through the tough questions of life and where you're heading.
I'm excited for us to take our own advice on this one, Jimmy.
I need to take my advice on this one. And you were the one that brought it up before we hit record. So I appreciate you mentioning that. But
if you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the podcasts over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Telemedicine Talks. Telemedicine is revolutionizing healthcare. Dr. Lee Damasco and Phoebe Gutierrez, Telemedicine Talks, bring you to the forefront of this digital transformation, featuring insights from pioneers and practitioners. Stay ahead of the curve, subscribe to Telemedicine Talks, and navigate the future of medicine with confidence.
I am curious, Justin, from your perspective as the financial planner. You mentioned earlier, and this is my experience too in medicine, by the way, and we've had this conversation on the show before about patients, like they just come in like, hey, you're the doctor. You did all the studying. You spent all the time. Just tell me what to do. And you mentioned that it's similar in the financial planning world a lot of the time. So when people are having these existential questions, in my opinion, this is one of the greatest reasons to have a financial advisor, a financial planner, is because they can help you sort through some of this and structure those conversations, be a sounding wall, be an objective third party if you're married between two people. And so how often are people coming to you and saying, hey, Justin, what are your thoughts on this? Like, do I have your blessing, your permission to do X, Y, or Z since I've always been this way before?
I had one of these this morning and assembling these data points. I'm not laughing at this person because they're experiencing their life in real time. But, you know, they bought a house for $1 million. It goes up to 1.2, 1.3. And they think, you know what? 1.6, 1.7 is kind of like, that will get me the dream home. And it obviously totally depends on your geography and all these other things. And they live in a high cost of living part of the country. And this was probably 12 months ago, and then it was 2.2, and I spoke with them this morning thinking, we're getting ready to move from the house we bought for $1 million, and we think that 2.7, that's really the number. I really think this is the last time we're going to revise it upward. And then it was do I have your blessing to do the 2.7, which, Jimmy, you know me well enough to say, like, if there's a way I could give someone permission to spend their own money or take on debt, perhaps in service of their goals and values, then I would say, go for it. And so, what do you think I said?
So two different simultaneous thoughts going on in my head parallel at the same time are, one, that you're going to make it happen if you can, given the resources that they have, if that is truly a goal for them. But you're also going to have a conversation with them about, let's see if this is actually a goal for you. Like, let's sit down and have this conversation. And I know that you think you want this, but let's really get down to the nitty gritty and think about where we are and what your goals are in life. And does this align with accomplishing all these other goals you have outside of just buying the house?
Yeah. And so this came up as like time to retirement, uprooting my kids to move across town, severing a lot of relationships with friends who it's not like we're never going to see them again, but we know they're not going to be in our lives and the community that we've built in this neighborhood. So all of these things kind of compounded and we stress tested a little bit to say, what if I told you that you were going to work until age 68 instead of age 57? Because, you know, we have a big, and I just sort of made these numbers up, but I was trying to stress test this idea of the trade-offs that we're building into their plan now to say, you're going to live a little higher on the hog, but if that's in alignment with your values of community, hospitality, you want to be in a certain zip code because of education for your kids, I'm not going to tell you that isn't important. I am going to observe that you're going to work longer, Are you okay with that? And when we put all these things sort of up on the cork board of our mind and looked at them together, it was like, there's no question that these things are so important to me that I understand there's going to be some stress. I understand there's going to be longer days. I understand my spouse is going to need to make more money, but this feels like a very natural fit based on our values. So hilariously and interestingly for me even, 12 months ago to today, we added $1 million to the presumed purchase price of this home. And
you're talking about your home.
No, of the home that they're going to purchase or that they're interested in purchasing. They were looking at the 1.7 and now we're at 2.7. And it feels like we have vetted it thoroughly such that they understand the trade-offs. They understand it. And we also said, like, if you get hurt, you know, you're going to be on your disability policy. You're not going to be making the big dollars. And so you can't afford that. That's a risk. You're going to have to literally sell your house. How do you feel about that? And that was something we put on the scale. And it's okay. Like, we came away from that conversation having consensus that, you know, life isn't safe. There's risks. That is a risk. I'm going to take the risk because we really want this for our family. So that was good. It's good to acknowledge the risks and then keep it moving.
Yeah. It's such a tough balance, right? Because you want it to be informed by their values, their goals.
Yeah.
Which if you're listening to this and you don't have a financial advisor, financial planner, you can do that. You can totally do that. There are exercises out there. Just mentioned the three Kinder questions to help you get like a big picture stuff in terms of what are your values? What are your goals? Where are you heading? What are you glad that you've accomplished? What are you wishing that you already had or regretful that you haven't? Those are big questions that point you in a direction and you can sort through some of this stuff, but I have found it helpful in pretty much every facet of my life when there's like that third party person I can say, hey, I want to bend your ear about this and talk me into it, talk me out of it. Like, give me all the angles on what you see based on your experience, based on your wisdom, based on your life and the education that you have. And it almost always informs my decision and will impact what I decide. You naturally have to be receptive to that. But there are definitely times where people have told me, and this happens, at least historically, most commonly in my business. Particularly, my sister was my business manager, Kristen, who, if you're a good listener, you just realize that my sister's name and my wife's name is the same. That's true. That's a fact. Spelled differently. So, but my sister, Kristen, she would all the time be like, Jimmy, I love your heart. I love you want to help people. I love you want to do this new, awesome thing for the business that's going to just really be amazing for all these people that you're serving. But by making that decision, you're breaking these 27 things in the business. So can we sort out those 27 things first before we move forward with Jimmy's extravaganza plan exhibit Z? And so she would often be the person that would tell me no as the operational person in my business. And so I've had that happen from a business perspective. I've had from a personal perspective, from a financial perspective. It is so, so helpful to bring somebody in to help you make these tough decisions, particularly if you're talking about a $2.7 million decision, right?
Yeah. And the compounded impact of that over decades being much more than that. I will say one other place I've seen this a lot, and I'm sure you've experienced this, and I personally have experienced this in my own life and by proxy through talking to many clients, especially the practice owners, are the business owner. Like, should I launch a business? Should I buy into a surgery center? Should I start a practice from scratch or become a partner at this company? That's another huge question. And that's another very values-laden question where often there are significant economic trade-offs where your upside is usually higher in business ownership than it is not, but the emotional toll is immense. And like the dispersion of potential outcomes just gets really wide. It could go awesome or it could go terrible. And you might have to slink back into W-2 land with your tail between your legs, having been economically devastated. And only if you are okay staring that in the face and saying, like, I know this might not work. I know I might run up a ton of debt. I know it could go terrible and I might have to go back to the place I came from and ask for my job back. Sorry for rage quitting. Can I please come here and see patients again?
That's why you don't burn bridges.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, don't burn, and I'm being facetious here, but the point is, if you're like, I know how terrible that would be, but I can't not do it because I'm tired of working for the man. And I talk to some people who are like that, and it's great to have that clarity because I'll tell you, there's going to be days when you're like, you're looking at that checking account balance, and you're looking at your line of credit that's sky high, and you're just like, why am I here? You're going to have these moments of like, I know why I'm here because I remember how bad it was, and hopefully you wrote it down because you're going to have to turn to that page in your journal or find that old email and remind yourself why you're doing what you're doing and it matters. And that is often how you're going to have enough gas in the tank to get out of those times.
I used to have this conversation all the time. Fortunately, my business model is so much simpler nowadays. It's super simple, right? We help people with financial literacy, and 99% of what I provide is completely free to people. This podcast, the Instagram, books. So 99% of my content is free. And then when you happen to need disability insurance, we can help you get disability insurance and money meets medicine disability. Like, those are the only two things that I do. But that wasn't always true. And I used to tell people all the time back when I had a coaching business, and that coaching business at its peak brought in 700 grand a year. And so when that happened, like, even though it was making more money than I did as an anesthesiologist, I would tell people all the time, and I stand by it, that running a business was more stressful than doing anesthesia. And anesthesia, when you make mistakes, people die, right? So for me, being an entrepreneur, I can't imagine doing it any other way. I think that you have to be cut from a certain cloth. I don't think everybody's an entrepreneur. I know enough people in my life that are not entrepreneurs to confirm that it takes a certain kind of person. And for that person, that emotional toil is worth it. But even when a business is doing well, sometimes it's not, to be honest. You know, sometimes running your own DPC, you're like, I don't want to work for the man. I'm going to do a direct primary care model. It's going to make so much more money. And but you don't think about all the administrative tasks and the overhead and all these other things that you don't have to deal with as a W-2 that you now as a business owner have to deal with. And the stress can skyrocket. And so, yes, you do have your freedom, my friend, but it may be at an emotional cost that you do not want to pay. And I have been there in my business, which is why I simplified things, because the amount of stress was ridiculous and my family paid for it, just like I did. And so I will say one more common situation, though, where this comes up, Justin, and you see this all the time, and this is probably a really short comment to make, but is people that listen to this show are going to be some of the most financially literate people, right? And we have people that graduate from Money Meets Medicine all the time. I'll get people that email me like, I used to listen to your podcast every single week, and I really got what I needed from it. And like, so thankful that we provide value and that people feel like they get to the point where they can move on and continue learning in other avenues. But everyone listening to the show is going to get to financial literacy. They're going to become a financially literate physician. And so what that means is that you're going to be the person, particularly if you find the show in your 20s or 30s, who when you are 50 or 60, have so much money, the problem is quite the opposite, my friend, where you will actually be more likely to die with too much money, more money than you started with, than spending it down, which is why you start thinking about things thoughtfully. Your kids probably want money when they're in their 20s, not when they're 60, right? Like, are there ways to be thoughtful about the amount of wealth you've accumulated so that you don't die as the richest man in the graveyard or richest woman in the graveyard that couldn't spend all their money if they wanted to, right? You can flip that switch sooner and help people out in your life, give to charitable causes, things that you care about. But flipping that switch when you get to retirement can also be super, super difficult. So as we wrap up, the whole point of this financial independence game, remember, the reason we talk about savings rates and asset allocation, tax loss harvesting, all that other stuff, isn't how high that number can get. It's to let you live a life that you actually like, to practice medicine on your terms. It's what you are able to do with money as a tool, because money is a tool. It is not the ends itself, right? It's a means to an end. So as you listen to this, think about that. Think about existential questions you might need to take some pause, like Justin and I do right now, and take some time away from the busy life that we have to allow space for that. Have that conversation with your wife, with your husband, with a loved one, and see where you are. See what your goals are. See if where you're heading aligns with that current trajectory. As always, thanks for being here. Don't forget, if you're a resident or fellow listening to this, or you have someone that you know that is, send them to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability to get a quote for disability insurance and check into any guaranteed standard issue GSI policies that exist where you are in training. All right, everybody. We'll see you next week. Cheers.
Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he helps anesthesiologists and pain medicine physicians. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing academic anesthesiologist at Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's also a licensed insurance agent. However, either Justin or Jimmy are your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should be considered financial advice. All views expressed are solely the views of the guests on the show and do not represent the views or opinions of their employer.